It's Saturday, August 24th, 2013. We recorded this August 19th. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KUSP Public Radio, 889 and KUSP.org. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxel. Please keep in mind the views expressed during KUSP's Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP or of the board, the Pataphysical Broadcasting Foundation, which is a nonprofit that actually owns and operates KUSP. And actually, in the air with me is Bonnie Jean Prim. She's a mediator and broadcaster. Hi, Bonnie.
Howdy.
I mentioned the Pataphysical Broadcasting Foundation, which I don't normally do because the...
For a reason.
Yes. And that reason is that the president of the Pataphysical Broadcasting Foundation, Kelly O'Brien, is also in the room with us. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, Lyle. Hi,
now,
Bonnie.
Hi.
Regular listeners to KUSP and, of course, podcast people that like good shows already know you quite well by your wonderful program, KUSP's Life in the Fast Lane. And this is a biweekly, two times a week broadcast, keeping you up to date. You want to describe your show for us?
Yeah. Lyle, it's been going on for about 7 years now, I guess. And sometimes I think I should just sit down and shut up, you know, because it 7 years is a long time.
Things keep happening, though.
Things keep happening. You made that point. And you just made it again now. And we started off doing this to inform people about alternative modes of transportation, alternative energy, with the idea that global warming is real and that we'd have to do something about it. And we can do something about it. The technology is there for us to do it. And so the idea was to start off describing some of the possibilities that were out there. And it's just expanded over the years.
Well, you know, in 7 years, 7 years ago, you didn't drive an electric vehicle, and now you do.
Well, actually, I did drive an electric vehicle. Yeah,
well,
7 years ago.
You are on top of it.
Well, that was the exciting part of it. You know, we had a Prius, but we also had a RAV4 EV, the original 2000.
I want that vehicle still.
Kelly's an early adopter.
Yeah. An early adopter, indeed. And that vehicle has been great. We had to give the first one we had back to Toyota because it was leased through our business. But we now own one. We bought a 2002 secondhand and with a new battery pack. We put 115,000 miles on the original one, which is a lot for a car that only gets 100-mile range.
Yeah.
And then this one's got about 98 on it, so we're just about to go over the 100,000-mile mark on this.
Does it still, with the new battery pack, did you increase your distance of travel?
You don't. Actually, it's a refurbished pack, so it just simply replaced the original. These were really, you have to realize that these early RAV4s, they were all hand-built. There are only about 1,500 of them made, and there's only about 400 left in service, maybe less now, because they're being replaced by the newer RAV4 EV and people are getting Teslas and the larger variety of electric vehicles and plug-ins that are out there.
Now, so, Kelly, we'll be talking more about transportation. In fact, that's why you're on. We're talking a lot about transportation today. All right, well, we're going to do some geek news, and we're going to get into talking about transportation. Bonnie?
Yeah.
Let's talk about high school instead first.
Yeah, so this is a story which, on the face of it, seems heartwarming, but of course, I managed to detect the sinister underbelly and everything, so I don't know if my detectorator is in overdrive here or not, but there's a company called Bot Objects, which makes 3D printers, and they've come up with a model that they want to introduce into high schools, and to get that idea going, they'll be giving away like 150, 200 of them to high schools and classrooms that apply to receive them. And these are multicolor 3D printers. So like you have a color cartridge that can produce any number of colors. This 3D printer can produce objects, multicolored objects.
Yeah, okay.
Which is fairly unique. I mean, usually you see sort of like base color ones.
A few of the high-end ones do that, and this is actually not that high-priced one, and does still color mixing, which is kind of cool. Because, you know, at the output of this device, you get a 3D model that is in color. That's
pretty cool. So they're starting off by giving away 150 to 200 of these things, and then they're going to reduce the cost by 65% to other high schools.
Whatever their real price will be.
Yeah, of whatever their real, which they're setting, to get it into as many high schools as possible. Yeah. And then they're going to offer fresh curriculum updates every year to keep high schools on the hook. And you can see sort of where my sinister detectorator is coming in. They're managing to infiltrate into high schools and set the agenda about what gets taught by getting there first.
Yeah, okay. I see your cynicism. I'll raise you with a, it's cool, they're giving them away. But I agree,
yeah, but
there's
then
some potential
printers,
risk there.
Like bot object printers are what the youth will know as 3D printers, and so then they will seek out bot object printers.
I think that's totally valid.
It's consumer
savvy.
Apple
did that as well, right? It makes a lot of sense to put your product in education. I think the curriculum based around the 3D printer is much more about, you know, your high school teacher doing physics or doing chemistry or something, or you're doing some kind of science class or a mechanical class of some sort, and all of a sudden how this thing hits your shop, you need help in defining your curriculum around these things because they're complicated.
True. Yeah.
But I agree.
It's one thing to have a cool object, another thing to be able to know how to use it.
I was excited by the story because I love being able to promote like something that high school can benefit from before the time when the deadline happens. And they're, you know, they're doing this in the future. Unfortunately, it's after the show actually airs. It's before the show actually airs. So it's the 23rd of August. If you submit your high school, you might get selected for that. So I'll go ahead and spam the social networks as well.
But. And we might check in with them every once in a while. But one thing it says here is that you can create 25 micron prints. And 25 microns, that's like the width of a human hair.
Yeah, that's the detail that you can print to. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Right. So sort of like the pixelated detail.
Right, how big the pixels are.
Got it.
And then I've seen a lot of these things you actually also then encase it with some kind of glue to hold it together, but that smooths out the edges, and so it, it gets pretty cool.
All right. So kind of cool, potentially creepy. Time will tell.
I'll go with that.
Okay.
So my story is kind of, it's, I found this fascinating. You know, everyone knows that the sea levels are actually rising because of global warming. That's a pretty standard thing. And the sea levels rise about an eighth of an inch every year, which is a problem. But in 2010 and 2011, that didn't happen. So, either of you aware of what GRACE is, all uppercase? Something
no,
in satellite.
Acronym stands for something. That's my guess.
Yeah, NASA's Gravity Recovery and Climate Experiment, GRACE. And what this is a gravity detection satellite that maps the planet and how dense it is. And what was curious is from June 2010 to February 2011, Australia was just a lot more dense than it should be. And what that means, of course, it's more massive, I should say, not more dense. It's more massive. Something was going on with Australia. And what was happening, they've discovered, that an El Niña occurred in 2010.
Yeah. It's either
La Niña
or El Niño.
I did exactly what I didn't want to do.
It could potentially be a post-gender storm event.
I like that, post-gender storm event. So La Niña happened. It began in 2010, and it went through 2011. And what was interesting about this one is that it basically brought water from the Indian Ocean and Pacific Ocean and dumped it on Australia. Now, Australia is interesting because it has this large, you know, the outback area.
It's a very dry area.
It's dry, it's large, and it's got rings of mountains. So it can actually hold quite a bit of water.
Oh.
Not indefinitely. And there was major flooding. And we're talking about water levels that were a foot above, 30 centimeters, a foot above its normal water level. So lots of flooding occurred during this time.
Yeah.
And it actually caused the ocean, the global ocean sea levels mean, to drop by a quarter of an inch. That's how much water was in Australia.
That's a big dry land.
That's a lot of, yeah.
Big splash.
That was a big dry land. Now it's a big wet land.
And actually now it's back again and dry.
It's back to dry.
Yeah, they're having horrible droughts. And yes, the sea levels are back to the loss that we've been seeing of the eighth of an
inch. We got it back.
So unfortunately, it was a temporary thing, but it was kind of interesting. Of course, it just throws more pain into the story and fight about global warming because sea levels didn't rise during that time period.
Yeah, but meanwhile, Australia experienced extreme flooding and drought.
Which, of course, is happening most likely because of global warming dynamic changes on the global planet scale. Anyway, this whole story I thought was really interesting. I'll link to it from geekspeak.org. In fact, everything we talk about up at geekspeak.org, whether we're live or pre-recorded, we put up a show page and talk a bit more about it. One thing I wanted to mention is that I'm really frustrated with tablet devices, specifically iOS. They do not do the things I want them to do. I've been using an Android device lately. Kelly, do you use it? What are you using, tablet devices?
I do, yeah.
What do you have?
I have an iPad.
Okay, so do you like the iPad? The iPad 3?
I do.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this. If you're going to watch a YouTube video and you start watching it, and then you want to also look at the email when the video kind of gets dull or there's something going on, you can't do that, right?
I'm pretty sure you can't. That's
right.
Correct, yes.
So Apple has this pretty specific thing of locking the task, the current active application full. And when you play video on an iPad, most interface, especially the YouTube interface, goes full screen. So multitasking is just something you don't do with a tablet. It's an actual an iOS device. Android's a little different. You can actually do some multitasking. Microsoft's Windows 8 is specifically one of their talking points is that there's a lot more multitasking support into it. Mm-hmm. It seems like a strange thing because, of course, you've got this very intimate device that's right in your lap. Why do you need to multitask?
But I'm still bored.
I find I'm still bored. I want to consume two videos and listen to audio and read something at the same time.
That's I'm sorry about your hard life, Lyle. That's too bad.
So Google just released a new version of YouTube for the Android, which does have this ability to do kind of a picture-in-picture at your screen, which I thought was kind of cool. And I'm also about to move away from an iOS phone. I'm going to move to Android.
You're crossing over.
Crossing over at some point. All right.
You heard it here first.
You did.
Hey, everyone.
You're listening to Geek Speak in the Air. With me is Bonnie Jean Primsch and Kelly O'Brien. I'm Lyle Troxell. We're not taking calls today because we are actually recording on Monday, August 19th. And we are going to do, of course, our little break to talk about some station business. So please stay with us. We got more stories. In fact, what we're going to be talking about is the Hyperloop. That's right. High-speed, rail-like action. Very exciting. Stay with us. Okay, so that's at 8:06.
I have, right. Yeah. So, which is about 12 minutes sooner than I thought it was going to happen. Yeah. I don't know why I thought it was going to happen at 8:18.
I think that we're okay, though. Yeah, maybe we're too soon.
I don't know. Did we really start at 54?
We started at 54.
Okay.
Is that too... It felt like the right amount of time.
No, yeah, I'm wrong. It's about right. It's about
right. I mean, I'm wrong, though. All right.
No, you're right.
All right.
This is a part we'll cut out later.
That's right.
We hope.
Always fun.
We'll hope you remember. All right, shall I do this? I'm going to read my thing I wrote about the 7th Avenue Project. Hey, if you're enjoying this program, consider checking out the 7th Avenue Project, which airs Sundays at noon at 88.9, or as a podcast from the talk section of KUSP.org. Every week, Robert Polly plucks the bright mind of someone in the arts or sciences and displays the contents in an engaging way for his listeners. If you are not one of his listeners already, you should be. Frankly, that's what I, Bonnie Jean Primsch, have to say about that. And so what it is you should be doing is listening to the 7th Avenue Project. It's Thinking Persons Radio with Robert Polly. It airs tomorrow at noon on KUSP, and you can also check out his website at 7thAvenueProject.com. Just one of the amazing shows here at KUSP, along with Life in the Fast Lane, which is hosted by our guest today, Kelly O'Brien. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, Bonnie. Thanks so much for the little plug there. We appreciate
yeah.
it.
So we got all excited about the Hyperloop, and we actually had a clamoring from listeners last week wondering why we weren't covering it on the show, and it's because we had this evil plot
in fact,
to cover with you, Kelly.
In fact, Edward emailed us right in the middle of the show.
Right,
said,
in the middle.
You went an entire... Oh, no, at the end of the show. You went an entire show without talking about Musk's Hyperloop. And he goes on to talk a little bit about what we'll be talking about. It's true that we were talking about the Hyperloop story before the show started, and we knew that you'd covered it on your show, and it felt like a perfect thing to talk about on Geek Speak. And I've been wanting to have you on the show for years because you have so much knowledge, and geeking out with you is a blast. So, first off... Let's hear how CNN covered this story, because why not, right?
Now look,
right.
This thing will travel at about 500 miles an hour.
Okay.
This thing will travel at about, well, that's a bullet train, 150 miles an hour.
Very fast. Just
this thing will travel at 12,000 miles an hour.
With your cars and airplanes and trains and shuttles. Let's talk about this.
So very technical, clearly. No,
full of technical savvy.
What are they describing there?
Yeah,
the scenario was that CNN commentator had a couple of toys on his desk, and he was demonstrating the various modes of transportation with these toys, and he was scooting them across, and he had one of the space shuttle, and then he, in the middle of all this, he started doing this whole kind of thing with the space shuttle.
He just started playing with the toys.
He started playing with the toys and getting really into it.
On national TV.
And everybody's kind of trying to figure out how they're going to actually make a story out of this, and of course they really couldn't, and that's where they left it. And
it's pretty sad.
Pretty sad, yeah.
All right. What's the Hyperloop?
Well, it's how best to describe it. Elon Musk takes a crack at it.
I can play that if you want.
Sure. Why don't you go ahead and do that? See what he has to say.
So it's cross between a Concorde, a railgun, and an air hockey table.
a Concorde, a railgun, and an air hockey table.
Right.
All right, I'll cover the... I mean, the Concorde's easy. It's just faster than sound. Right.
Right. All right. Supersonic.
And in hockey table, you're blowing air up from the bottom of the table. You've compressed air. And the puck, flat and larger than an average of the dots, just floats on that cushion of air. The air flows out of it. It's very much like a... one of those wonderful devices that you can't steer.
Hovercraft.
Yeah.
Zamboni. The air hockey... favorite game of my youth, because it's just so, you can get that puck to go so fast.
Yeah, almost no friction.
It's such fluid motion right across the table. Really nice.
Yep. Okay, so the railgun. Now, I played a lot of role-playing games in my youth, into my 30s, and late, and maybe I keep playing them. I don't
Busted.
Know. Yeah, and there's a whole game series called Rifts, and railguns are very common in Rifts, and it's a very powerful weapon. And I know that it basically is a magnetic field where you throw an object in that field. You basically you make a whole bunch of magnetic fields in front of the object, and the object gets pulled and through the device, and if you time it all right, it goes really, really fast.
Right, exactly.
So,
yeah.
But you described that a railgun actually does have two rails, and I didn't get that.
It does, yeah.
I thought it was always...
The deal with a railgun is that it requires a pair of parallel rails, and there's a sliding armature that connects the two rails. It completes the circuit.
Oh, okay.
And in its weaponized version, a railgun puts a projectile in the middle, which is also conductive, and then using a very powerful pulsed electromagnetic source.
Like a giant capacitor, basically. You just fill it with for days of trickle charge, and then you have just tons of power.
Tons of power. And what it does is just blows this thing out, dumps the armature on the way, and this projectile flies at anywhere from Mach 7 to Mach 10, 10
yeah.
times the speed of sound.
That'll get you to L.A. fast.
That'll get you to L.A. fast. There's no doubt about it.
Well, so, I should say it will get robots to L.A. Unfortunately, we have brains, and those can't do that. Now, the railgun idea is very much like a linear accelerator, right?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, very much. It's like a particle accelerator idea taken to extreme. The interesting thing is that the railgun, one way to look at it is a sustainable weapon system. Because
that's so PC.
I love that we're talking about transportation and weapon systems.
Exactly. I know. Well, the interesting thing is that a lot of these technologies, as you know, come from weapon systems or space technology.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Hyperloop really shares a lot of this technology, not only with weapon systems like the SR-71 Blackbird spy plane, for example, but also other technologies developed through the space program. But in the case of the railgun, the interesting thing about it is that it requires no propellant. So there's no rocket or fuel, solid fuel on board, or no explosive. And the sheer impact of the projectile is what explodes the target. So there's no warhead or unexploded ordnance left over.
Now the point about this has to do with like space travel in general. The complication emerges with fuel. Right,
yes.
Because you to propel yourself, you have to actually, if you're a free-floating body, you have to push stuff out of your system. So an ion spacecraft throws ions out the back. Mm-hmm. It can go for a long time, but it does run out of source at some point. Yeah. And any other kind of jets and things of that nature, the jet system uses the airflow and propellers, basically, but a little more complicated, and fuel flame. But the idea is that you're actually throwing material away from you, and, of course, an opposite reaction, you go forward and your stuff goes backwards, and that's how propellers work. Really works. But when you're talking about in a railgun situation, it's very much that you actually have your power sources being delivered along the rails or along the tube the entire time, and then after that happens, no more. It's much more like a bullet, right?
That's right.
That's why
It's
called a gun.
Yeah, it's a pulse shot, and it's it happens very, very quickly, and it's a huge power surge. Which propels the projectile.
Now, from my understanding, just to describe, because the rail thing you were talking about, the circuit being closed with it, I always thought the rail gun, the thing that's going to be thrown out, the bullet, the charge, whatever, was sitting on that track just to hold it up prior to the electromagnetic fields engaging it and grabbing it. I thought that track and rail was just superficial to its actual power source. I thought the power source was actually coils around the chamber. Seems like no, not necessarily.
Not so.
Okay.
Not so.
So in this vehicle, in the Hyperloop, this proposal that Musk made, this is a tube where people sit in it, and we're not going to accelerate that fast.
Precisely.
But we will be able to go high speeds. But the idea is that it's it's not going to have, like, casters on it. It's going to have an air vacuum around it. That's the whole the table that you're talking about. What is it called?
Air hockey table.
Mm-hmm. So let's describe just the way that this craft, it's basically like a subway station, right? It's a mm-hmm. subway kind of car, and the tube is kind of doesn't have a lot of air in it. How does this air thing actually keep it from touching the sides?
Yeah. Yeah, good question. Well, let's start from the capsule point of view. The capsule is, as you describe it, it really looks like it's rigid. So it's not flexible or articulated in any way, which is why the loop turns have to be so wide, to be able to allow the capsule to travel through a turn without flexing. So effectively what you have in the tube is a relatively tightly fitting capsule that in which the passengers are enclosed, that it's pressurized so that human beings can survive in it naturally. But the interesting thing is that the tunnel itself is not completely evacuated because it's a very, very difficult thing to create a pure vacuum.
Yeah, it's hard to get all the air out.
Absolutely, yeah. So to make major energy draw to do that and hard to maintain. So in Hyperloop, the tube is evacuated to about, as Musk describes it, about the atmosphere, 6 times below the atmosphere of Mars, so which is about, it's fairly low, 0.01, I believe, PSI.
So there's not a lot of air left in there.
Not a lot. But when you're traveling at high speeds, that air makes a difference.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you what you then...
Let's just do one thing. When you say capsule, it mm-hmm. makes sense from like, it seems like a very spacey kind of term, but we're talking like a car, a traveling vehicle, I mean, a thing that people sit in.
Right.
And the description they have is a 6-foot-tall tube that mm-hmm. you sit down in, 2 seats next to each other, mm-hmm. kind of like a train car, right?
Yep.
It'll fit 28 passengers, and that
right.
will be one pod, one...
That's right, one
thing.
Pod.
And I'm assuming you'll get into it and it'll tighten up and it'll be like
precisely.
Okay. So that thing is what we're talking about. It's mm-hmm. rigid. It doesn't actually flex. So if you've ever been in a subway station, you see that multiple cars actually curve and stuff. That can't happen.
Right.
And because it has to be so close around, which you're going to get to why in a second, the loops have to be really wide. So there's not a lot of rotation or turning. You can't turn very sharply.
That's right. You can't.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So you got this tube, and it's really close. How close are we talking about from the sides of the tube?
It was like 3/10 of a... What was it?
It's a very
tiny.
Close fit. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a very close fit. And actually, it depends on what we're talking about, how far from the side, because the capsule itself is about 4.5 feet wide. So it's not exactly... It's not circular, mm-hmm. At least in the description. So the thing is that it has to be tight fitting, yes, but it can't be so tight that you choke, that the choke flow of what air remains in the tube slows you down. Normally that would happen. It's called the Kantrowitz limit, and this is something that applies, this particular limit applies to airflow, fluid flow, at subsonic speed and hypersonic speeds. And what it means is this Kantrowitz limit prevents air from passing. Chokes down around the vehicle. Now, this is most recently it's used in jet engine design.
Okay.
And this is why Musk has got such an incredible wealth of knowledge. He, of course, is a CEO of SpaceX. Tesla, the electric side of it, mm-hmm. and also Solar City, which speaks to the solar panels and stuff. This kind of unique knowledge, these knowledge sets, come together in Hyperloop to really enhance and really clearly lay out the problems, potential problems associated with Hyperloop and how to overcome them.
Okay. This brings to mind the way a hard drive head reads. Do you know that idea? When you're spinning a hard drive really fast, the head actually floats on a cushion of air that attaches. The mm-hmm. air is kind of attached to the disk. Mm-hmm. You can think of it that way. So the moving surface captures some air molecules. The head rides on top of that, and it actually flies above the surface. Mm-hmm. Is this similar to what's happening in this Hyperloop?
In a certain sense, yeah. What happens is, now here's the difference between, say, this analogy of an air hockey table. The table itself generates the air upon which the puck travels. But in the case of the Hyperloop module, all of the air is generated from within the unit itself. So the traveling unit has an air large turbine compressor on it. It's driven by an onboard battery system that compresses the air in such a manner that it will blow some out the bottom. So, and this is to overcome the Kantrowitz limit. Mm-hmm. See, what it actually does is that, according to Kantrowitz, this thing is now going to be traveling at 0.91 Mach, right?
Okay.
So just below the speed of sound, 700
like 760 miles per hour.
Yep, really there. So what happens is that air that remains in that tube will tend to bunch up in front of it. It has nowhere to go. It's going to slow down and cause some real problems, including heating of the capsule. So what happens is that this onboard compressor will compress the incoming air and blow it out the bottom and pass it under the capsule and out the back.
So it's like eating and digesting and letting out air.
So it's like a jet in that sense, that it has to pull the air in to get it out behind you.
Yes, but it doesn't propel the capsule.
It's just using it for
getting
it. It's
just overcoming this particular limitation.
It's for balance.
Can you describe, like, in a chemical or physics way, what this... what is it called?
Kantrowitz limit.
Kantrowitz limit.
Yeah.
What's actually happening?
Yeah. What'll happen is that, let's take, for
example, in fluid dynamics perspective.
Yeah, well, it might be hard for me to explain that precisely, but
okay.
Let me say this. As you know, as you approach supersonic speed, a wave, a standing wave, begins to
emerge around the craft.
Emerge around, especially around the engine nacelle, for example, in a jet engine. So behind that wave is subsonic flow.
Mm-hmm.
Subsonic flow is what you need to power most jet engines, other than something called a scramjet, which is a supersonic compressed ramjet engine.
Which basically needs to take air. It uses the lower pressure air and uses that as a propellant system.
Well, in the scramjet, it wants supersonic airflow.
Right. That's why you have to drop those vehicles already going really fast for
Newark.
Exactly.
Precisely. Yes, exactly. So, in any case, the way to over you can manipulate this. So, for example, in the SR-71 Blackbird spy plane, and some of the Russian jets, the way they did this was that if you look up the SR-71 and look at it, the engine nacelles in front had a cone, and that cone slid in and out depending on what Mach number you were doing, or if you were doing a slower speed,
changing that standing wave.
It would change the standing wave and slow down the airflow so that it was subsonic, because the jet engine needed that air in order to function. And the interesting thing about the jet engine in the SR-71, it was that it was a dual stage or a dual mode engine. It was a turbojet at below supersonic speeds, and then it would turn into a ramjet thereafter.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a ramjet inside a turbojet.
Cool.
And this manipulation system was really tricky to get this right, because what would happen, they call airflow that's working in a supersonic engine starting the engine. Now, I don't know where the term comes from, but if that breaks down, they call the engine unstarted. And if that happens in a twin jet engine, it's very bad. It's just the machine yaws violently to one side.
Ooh.
So what they ended up doing in the SR-71 is that if one engine unstarted, they'd unstart the other and then start them both the same, so they wouldn't get
workaround.
Wow. But I mean, it was so violent that the pilots would hit their heads against the canopy
serious. This is something that I'm a little concerned about with this hypertube.
Yeah, go ahead.
It's going 760 miles per hour, and it will have to go around even a shallow curve. So how is it that it's not going to bump up against the sides of the tube if it's such a short distance between the pod itself and the tube?
It's the cushioned air that is the turbine, onboard turbine, has developed a tremendous amount of pressure that's sent through feet, basically skis, on the pod that keep it away from the side of the tube. Now, these things are made of Inconel, which is a kind of nickel chromium alloy used in spacecraft, which is, again, Elon Musk's experience with SpaceX, right up his alley. So these skis, then, long things as well, have a number of holes on the bottom, and through those holes is ejected the air from the compressor, which levitates it.
The skis are the air hockey table,
they are,
basically.
Right. Yeah.
So
exactly.
The thing that's going to bump the side will be the skis.
Well, in fact,
well, the sides,
except
though,
they won't touch.
I mean, it's. I get it that there's going to be air sort of cushioning it from below, but what about the sides? That's what I don't understand.
Well, actually, if you think of, let's think of you're in a circular chamber, let's assume for just a second you want to brace yourself within it. You probably do it 4 points. Your both feet and both hands.
Yeah.
So if you consider that it's possible to do it that way. But my guess is...
So there'd be skis up top also?
There could be.
Oh.
There could be. But more than likely, they're both just going to be on the bottom.
Yeah.
And the control system for the pod that guides it, because there are some very, very tight tolerances going through this propulsion system, mm-hmm. this electromagnetic propulsion system that boosts the pod every 70 miles. It has to pass through very precisely. It's only 10 centimeters on either side of the stator. That's the skid mm-hmm. On the side of the or on the bottom of the pod.
This is the electromagnetic field that accelerates
yeah.
it.
Uh-huh. That's right. This is the kind of particle accelerator or railgun effect
we're
talking about. Mm-hmm. So the key things to understand about this is that the electromagnetic propulsion system is there to accelerate and boost the capsule through its travel. The second thing is that the onboard compressor doesn't propel the vehicle at all. It simply levitates it.
And probably deals with any kind of stabilization issues as well, right? Like, it'll be able to slightly move itself, right, to line it with the next. Yeah.
Sure.
I mean, it seems to
sure.
me that the trick of this, of course, is that it's an intelligent system that's going to be correcting itself all the time. That's
yes,
the height of
exactly.
At extremely high speeds, ladies and gentlemen.
I'm more concerned, honestly, about particulates and problems. And, you know, someone leaves a screw in this tube and you've got mm-hmm. a problem.
Yeah.
And that seems to me much more of an issue. And also, like, how would you clean it? Because as much as we think of ourselves as ability to have a perfect clean environment for long periods of time, we're talking about hundreds of miles.
Sure.
So,
well, and he's talking about having one of these things shoot from one end to the other every 2 minutes.
Yeah,
that's right.
Which seems like an
that's
enormous
right.
amount of traffic going back and forth.
If you only have like 28 people per pod, you got to keep going.
Well, that's true.
Yeah,
it's possible to take them. You know, he addresses these problems. He says, for example, unloading the pod can be done and the vehicle turned on around on a turntable if necessary. So the other thing is the quick unload scenario is the people get out, and almost like in a pallet-like manner, the baggage compartment gets unloaded in a module, mm-hmm. and it's ready to go.
Right. So again, it feels very much like one of these bank pneumatic tubes where you've got something inside it that you take out mm-hmm. and you put back in, right? So it's everybody comes out
every
and everything comes out.
5 minutes? I mean, what's the rush?
Yeah. There may not be a rush, in fact. You know, so I think
you could also just have a lot more pods and just have subchambers where you push the pod out the side. You know, you could have multiple pods in the system, I'm assuming.
You could. Yeah, absolutely, you could. And of course, you know, there are a lot of problems that have to be addressed. For example, airlock, so that you can bring the pod into a docking station, even a side station,
yeah.
and depressurize within there. These things are not, there's not big
it's
technology
not worked out yet,
to do that.
The other thing to note about this, and this is one of those things that you keep coming back to on your show, is that we need this kind of technology because our current mode of transportation is based completely on petrol.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that just isn't sustainable. So we have to think of other ways of traveling people fast. Trains are pretty good at that idea. A lot of them, of course, are diesel. Mm-hmm. But in this situation, what we're talking about is a battery inside the vehicle to deal with the turbo engine thing, mm-hmm. the airflow, and then the electrical stations along the way, which, of course, would be solar, I would assume.
That's right.
And they just need to do pulses. So it's an interesting kind of current draw, right? You mm-hmm. you charge your capacitors probably and fire the couple times as they pass these segments.
Yeah.
The things I'm concerned about have to do with just, in general, how a completely new type of... I mean, when we started flying, the human species started flying, we weren't really good at it. And there was a lot of death and a lot of problems. And over the years, we've gotten pretty good at it. So
I think
this
it's gonna
take
a long
thing,
time
right?
for development to make sure that everyone feels safe, and there's already a plan in place called high-speed rail.
Yeah.
And so there's usurping the plan in progress to switch it out with this thing. Oh,
well, it's a good question to ask, I think, Bonnie. I think high-speed rail I've never been a fan of either. I really agree with Elon Musk on it. It's you know, I can understand the social aspect of it is to bring economic prosperity to the Central Valley mm-hmm. in part. Mm-hmm. So I can understand that. But it really is a low-tech and somewhat, you know, it has its risks as well. I mean, both of these systems would be vulnerable to some kind of terrorist attack. High speed rail does take a lot of acquisition of land. and right of way.
Oh, you know, let's get into that in just a second. We're going to talk a little bit about high-speed rail and its some of its problems, and I'm curious about the tube itself, a little talk about that. We are chatting about the Hyperloop proposal by Elon Musk. And this is Lyle Troxell on GeekSpeak, and Bonnie Jean Primsch is here with me, and Kelly O'Brien is here as well. We're going to continue our conversation, so please stay with us. You're listening to GeekSpeak on KOSP, and you can learn everything we talk about from links and such we put together up at geekspeak.org. Please feel free to join us up online, and of course on social networks you can follow us as well and find out all about what we're doing. Today's show is pre-recorded. We recorded Monday, August 19th in the evening. Okay, so Kelly, you say that trains take a lot more space than this rail thing. I'm going to get into how this new Hyperloop thing, how it would actually work with space usage. But one of the things that also high-speed trains do is that you have to have a giant motor that you also move back and forth. And from a physics perspective, you're basically, it's expensive to move all that stuff, right? Back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And it doesn't really do anything for you except for drive the vehicle. So there's a flaw in that sense of the train idea. Is there anything? What else is wrong with that? Why aren't you in favor of high speed rail? You're the first person I've ever heard that really said no, it's not a good idea. Now we're talking about this podcast is all over the planet. Of course, lots of listeners from all over the place. We're talking about California, Central Valley, because that's where we are right now. Mm-hmm. That's what we're talking about. We're actually on the coast. What's wrong with it? What's wrong with it?
Well, I think that the issue with it, and this is the same for Hyperloop, because you've got to have infrastructure at both ends, the destinations, you know, and along the route as well, and that infrastructure is as yet to be accounted for in the price. And how that infrastructure is designed, I think, is important. I, for one, am in favor of something that Europeans have really hit on called multimodal transportation. So there are, if you will, key hubs within an area. And when this mass transportation, like Hyperloop or like the California rail project, arrive at a destination, then there's a lot of modes of transportation available. It could be taxi, it could be car sharing, it could be bicycle, that's bicycle sharing. It could be any number of different modes to get you from point to point, public transportation, a bus and the like. These things are not well planned usually. They just end up willy-nilly. So that's common to both. But my fear with high-speed rail is when it costs a tremendous amount of money, for one thing. The second thing is I'm not clear, based on Amtrak's performance, for example, that people are going to really want to ride it. And the second thing is I think the price is going to be pretty high to do so, and the schedule not really very friendly.
Okay. France's high-speed rail is a very successful way to get across the country. It's slowish, right? It takes you a while to take the train across the country. But it's kind of comparable to flying in the sense that, you know, with flying, of course, the security is a little bit harder. Yep. You have to get there an hour and a half earlier or whatever. And I recently flew across France and somebody else took the train. And, you know, we saw each other in the morning and then we saw each other that evening in Paris. And he took the train and I took the plane, right? Yep. I mean, of course, it took him longer in some sense. But then again, I don't know, I had the cab ride from the airport over, and he didn't. He showed up at one of the stations. So, I don't know, I think it's successful in France, and I think high-speed rail is successful in Japan.
Yeah, it's a different, you have to realize that, this is difficult for us to understand, but if you talk to Europeans about the United States, I think most of them will say, my goodness, you people have such an incredible amount of space there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, it's wonderful. It's why people like to come here in part, apart from the natural wonders too. But in Europe, space is at a premium. And there's a culture of far more social responsibility in transportation than we have in this country. You know, in this country, we have a different approach to it. You know, it's monster
trucks.
Yeah,
there's like a whole report on last weekend's weekend, All Things Considered, about the death of the car. You know, kids aren't clamoring for the car as their symbol of freedom anymore. They're not bothering to get driver's license. Mom and dad will drive us around, and there's ways to get around it. But that's sort of still ingrained in our culture, that the car is the whole point.
Yeah, you make a really good point there, Bonnie, and I think that I heard someone, my son actually, gave an interpretation about that. I said, you know, it's interesting that this is happening, that young people don't seem to be interested in cars. And he said, well, part of the reason is that we have all these digital devices that take up our time. We spend our time, we used to watch TV, and now we're doing a PlayStation or my phone, or I'm texting. And if I need to get from point A to point B, you know, physically, I'll figure out a way to do it. But most of the communication that's done between my friends and I are done on digital devices.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. We're not as isolated from each other, us young people.
Precisely.
I'm pretending to be a young person.
And the desire to leave home isn't quite the same because it's expensive to leave home now.
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah. Jeez. Yeah. So good luck, Mom and Dad.
You're right.
What's Hyperloop's tube made of?
Well, the description is steel. In Musk's paper.
The steel is about
0.7, 0.8, around that way, thickness. So it's about 3/4 inch thickness.
That's a lot of steel.
It's a lot of steel. Yeah, but of course, when you do it in mass and kind of a standardized fashion.
What about expansion and contraction?
Expansion joints
and stuff. Yeah,
yep.
Plastic expansion joints or metal expansion joints?
I believe that they're metal expansion joints,
wow.
But I'm not really sure. Yeah.
What about metal expanding, contracting because of heat or cold? And then
that's exactly the reason for them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you want that kind of flexibility.
Well, the diameter expansion and contraction won't be very much, but the lengthwise will be drastic.
Yeah. What about the pod bumping up against the sides of expanding or contracting
metal? I
think
you're feeling the New York subway effect. It won't feel that way.
No.
I have the image that it's just going to be a super jostly ride. Yeah.
Yeah, not so much.
And, like, really fast. Well, what is he says in here that, you know, it won't go any faster than, you know, 0.5, Mach 0.5 or whatever. Was that it?
0.91. Yeah.
0.91 Mach. But that the force won't be more than half a G.
Oh, right. Now, you wouldn't want to do that to people.
That's what he was shooting for. Yeah. Now, that's an interesting
But even at like 0.2 of a G, people are starting to get nauseous and a little ill.
Well, that point was made by the developer of maglev railways or transportation systems, and he had mentioned that, you know, they'd seen people getting nauseous at 0.2 G.
Okay.
And actually, I looked up a study on roller coasters, and roller coasters actually exceed that for some periods of time.
And people get nauseous,
and
Kelly.
They do get nauseous.
Designed to make people a little bit out of sorts.
But the curves are drastic by comparison, you know.
Yeah, that's true.
And so, again, if you read the paper, and a lot of people haven't read the paper, that's the problem with a lot of critics, is that they get a notion and they believe that this might be some kind of... it's some kind of gray matter expectoration by Elon Musk. You know,
that was my description on Geekspeak.
Is that right?
Yeah.
There you go.
It's like, and then your brain hits the back of your head.
Exactly.
Now, of course, it won't accelerate like that, right?
Yeah.
And that would be a problem. What the G's we're talking about is how quickly the effect on your body of movement, right? So when a vehicle turns really quickly,
in a turn,
you stand on the planet Earth,
precisely. Kind of effect, well, the idea is in this particular scenario is that the capsule will bank as it goes into the turn slightly.
It'll feel always downward.
You'll have a vector effect, you know, on your mostly toward your butt.
I'm always amazed when I fly how little you feel
the
effects of movement and stuff because you bank, of course, so the down is always feels like it's the floor, even though there's forces going different directions.
Yeah.
It still scares me, the idea that you're going to get into something that could technically go very fast, very quickly, accelerate really fast.
And if there's a problem, it will be kind of an extreme result.
Yeah.
Right?
Does this thing take up as much space as a train, or can you go underground? You go a lot deeper. Is it going to be a dig, or is it going to be above ground?
It's going to be above ground. And you could put it below the ground. That's an option. I think it's more expensive to do that, and I think the idea that he had was to keep it as cheap as possible. So one of part of the proposal spoke to running this down the center divider of I-5.
Right.
That's the straightest run that it would have.
And putting it 15 feet above the...
And putting it 15 feet, exactly.
And this would actually probably be two tubes, right? So they could go...
That's the loop.
Yeah. One way there and one way back.
Exactly. Yeah.
By sticking mostly to the Highway 5 route, there's a minimum of extra land you have to buy.
So I see.
But in places where you kind of have to because of curves...
Mm-hmm.
His thinking was because it will be up on posts, then people can still get around on their land and they aren't as inconvenienced as they were if it was just like smack.
And they just
the
sell
ground.
Advertising stickers all over it to pay for it.
I imagine.
So, you know, the thing that's so funny is it feels to me like what the conversations were when subway systems were being put in cities, and it's the same kind of idea. How people would be shot through these tubes, pneumatic tubes, and you know, this same conversation happened 80 years ago, 100 years ago, however long it was. Yeah. And this idea that, oh, we'll just put them above the city. And of course, now the areas that have subways above the city are the not so pleasant places to live.
Right. Yeah. So I don't, I mean, that I sort of believe that this could happen if you calculate in twice as much expense and half as much awesomeness. Do you know what I mean? Like, that's probably how it'll wind up being.
Well, I think that any time you engage in a highly, you know, in a technical advance, you really want to push that envelope as much as possible because over a period of time, it will be old school. It'll be slow.
So you aim for the moon to hit the fence.
Yeah, partially. But also, by the time you start to actually build it, the technology's problems that emerged will have been fixed. You know, this is a great idea in space travel that the best way for us to get to another solar system is to just wait because the technology will get better. If we started now, we wouldn't get there as soon as waiting for 50 years and then doing it. But how much money are we talking about?
$6 billion
to get from San Francisco to Los Angeles. Is
that the entire he estimated $6 billion for the whole shoot and match. Well, $60 billion was what, and he estimates it might be $100 million for the California High Speed Rail project.
$100 billion.
Excuse me.
More expensive than
the more expensive
and slower.
And slower. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Seems like we got to do it. The thing that's interesting to me about these topics, when you think of this kind of crazy scale, like our brains can't really comprehend billions of, you know, value. Right? That's too big. So when you start thinking of the scale, you have to start thinking about it as a species decision. Like it's a large scale change of who we are as a species. So yes, it's crazy. Absolutely. And what we're doing right now is crazy. The idea that we all have, I mean, all three of us drove down here, right?
Yeah.
Somebody has a Tesla that drove down an electric vehicle. But us poor schlubs use petrol. And that's not sustainable. And the amount of money and infrastructure we put just maintaining our road system to do these things, like I-5, for example.
And they need help.
We've already made that decision, and we've been doing it for years.
Yeah.
So it's really just about, I mean, if we had no roads right now, and we proposed to pave the country, people would think we're insane. That's completely ridiculous. And yet we've done that. I mean, you go outside right now, you touch concrete or asphalt, that asphalt goes across the continent. Mm-hmm. Like, that's crazy.
Yeah.
But we've done it.
Well, we've done it. And the interesting thing is that...
I wish we hadn't.
Yeah, but there it is.
Well, there's another crazy idea that you may have heard of. It's called solar roadways. And it's a guy in Idaho, actually, who got a grant from the DOE to do this and build a prototype. And his idea, and I think it's a great one. The trouble is that it's a materials issue, I think, in part. But he had a successful prototype. And the deal was that he would build solar panels into the current tarmac road system, and along each road in a trench would go everything from internet to cable and all across country. And by his calculations, if this was done across country, then the East Coast could run the West Coast at sunrise.
Oh, wow.
And vice versa.
Yeah, cool idea. Yeah.
A very cool idea. And it actually looks pretty cool because you could put, for example, LEDs in the roadway to change traffic patterns, et cetera.
Yeah. So you basically make smart roads that are powered and the whole deal. Yeah,
cool idea.
I love how around town here in Santa Cruz, we see solar panels going up above parking areas, which is so smart. I got to do this. You're driving a Tesla.
Right.
What do you think?
Well, it's one of the reasons why I like Elon Musk, I think, in part, you know.
Someone's got a tech crush.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I did this piece on Life in the Fast Lane where I called him, you know, I actually pulled out that that part of the Dos Equis ad, you know, of the most interesting man in the world, and used the cut. But the thing is that he, of course, was a lead designer and one of the co-founders of Tesla. A lot of people involved in that. There's no doubt about it. But he's a visionary guy. And the thing I like about him is that he is an incredible risk taker. I mean, and he's willing to stand it. You know, it's incredible. Mm-hmm. And he usually comes through. The Tesla Model S is an amazing car in this way. It's really a rolling computer more than anything else.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, you know, this this morning I got up and I got a message on the screen of the car that said, would you like to update the software now or later to version 5? And, you know, you just simply say, okay, later, because it's going to cause you not to be able to drive the car and stop the charging. But the improvements are dramatic.
So you see improvements in the vehicle?
Absolutely.
It gets upgraded?
Oh, my gosh.
Yep.
Oh my
gosh. The map system changes, for example.
Did you say drivability?
Yeah, drivability of the car can change as well.
You don't upgrade while you're driving?
No, you're not.
But how does like a car actually become easier to drive when it's the same car?
It's the way that we have to realize everything is drive by wire in the car. There's almost nothing. For example, there's, as you know, the 17-inch screen in the center console, and the driver's screen in front of you, where miles per hour and navigation all that stuff is displayed. Those are all digital. Controls. There are, apart from the steering wheel and the usual things like cruise control and turn signals and windshield wipers, washers, on the stock, everything else is digital. So there are two other buttons. One's the emergency lights business, the emergency flashers, and the other is the open the glove box. So
okay,
the only two. But if you see the Tesla chassis, the Model S chassis at, say, Santana Row in San Jose, you realize that because this thing has got air suspension shocks, right, they're not regular shock absorbers, you've got this giant battery skateboard upon which is the chassis, right?
Yeah.
And then at either end, you have servo motors and various other controls in the front and nothing more. You know, you look at it and you say, there's a holy cow.
Yeah, yeah.
The whole thing is drive-by-wire. So it's a rolling computer. And it's a beautiful-looking car on the other side of the equation.
What's your mileage cost? Let's say you're doing a commute up and down from your house and to KUSP.
So my KUSP round trip is somewhere around, I think, 140 miles from where I live.
And that costs you?
Probably around $2.50.
$2.50.
Yeah.
It's a little cheaper than gas. Well, we have to wrap it up on Geek Speak. Thank you so much, Kelly, for coming and talking about Hyperloop. What a wonderful thing. If you want to hear more about the story and great audio show, listen to Kelly's show. It's fantastic. I highly recommend it. It's on KUSP. And is it podcasted separately as
it
well?
Is.
Yeah,
it
good.
Is. Yeah. NPR podcast, yes.
Through NPR.
Through iTunes.
Yes.
Yeah. Thanks for having me, you guys.
And that's
really
Life in the Fast Lane with Kelly O'Brien on KUSP. And Bonnie Jean Primsch, thank you so much.
Yeah.
I'm Lyle Troxell. You can learn more about the show up at geekspeak.org. And Kelly and Bonnie, thank you for joining me.